Let's make sure you're in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with Jesus' response, which, of course, and as I had pointed out before, ironically enough, it comes from Moses. It isn't the part they wanted quoted, but this also was written by Moses as well. So we got down to point 12 again, while our main verse here, God made them male and female. Well, that doesn't really tell you anything necessarily about marriage or divorce. It just tells you that there are two distinct genders that God has created. And in 13, there is a significant textual issue in verse 7, which revolves around the question as to whether or not the phrase "to be joined or united with his wife" was originally present in Mark. There is no question that a similar statement was included in Matthew's account. Which some believe to have been inserted here in order to conform Mark to Matthew. Well, B, however, there is the potential that the phrase was original in Mark and was inadvertently omitted through what is known as parablepsis. This is one of the things that when people copy text, it's a known phenomenon. Literally means to see alongside. And this occurs when the scribe would miscopy the text because his eye jumped from one word to the same word, causing him to omit the intervening text. Well, D, in this case, the scribe's eye may have jumped from the chi in verse 7 to the next usage of chi at the beginning of verse 8. And there are certainly two chis in there. So you have a potential issue where a guy could be looking at a thing and see and then a phrase and then inadvertently skip to that second and omit it. So that's the reasoning as to why one could do this. So in this case, the scribe's eye may have jumped from the chi in verse 7 to the chi at verse 8. Well, E. while Metzger, who's really probably primarily the chief voice of textual criticism in some way, I mean, he doesn't do it all by himself. He works with a committee of students and biblical scholars, recognized that the probabilities were closely balanced. The committee finally determined to leave the text, but to include it in brackets to denote its uncertainty. But as they observed, the phrase does seem to be necessary to the sense of what is being said. Otherwise, one might understand the two to refer to the more immediate antecedents, the father and the mother. Well, gee, in the end, the textual issue does not change any doctrine, as we know. It's not an issue in that sense. And the text of Genesis and Matthew are not suspect. However, it would seem that the shorter, more difficult reading was the original in Mark. So I put it in brackets. I did just exactly what the other guys did. But in a sense, I think it does make it plainer to the English reader as to what's going on here. But again, Mark's version of almost all things tends to be short and to the point. And he doesn't include here, say, the exception about adultery, where Matthew clearly does. But again, we know that that was fundamental doctrine that everybody knew. Well, it's also fundamental doctrine everybody knows that the man is to be joined to his wife and the two become one flesh. That's the fundamental doctrine. We know he's not talking about the mother and father. So even if the text is here, or not here rather, you say that you wipe that out, we've got enough other evidence and our doctrinal grid should tell us that this is the sense of it, at any rate. So 14, having appealed to the initial divine design, which he clearly recognized as the original purpose of God, Jesus now moves to the next verse from Genesis, which provides God's purpose in the creation of a single man and a single woman. Again, as we point out, Genesis 2:24, all of this is instructive. God didn't make anything other than one man and one woman. Now, he could have made multiple men, multiple women, and said, hey, you guys figure it out. But he reveals his design in the sense that there's no other way this can be. If there's going to be a relationship and there's only one man and one woman, well, do the math. It has to be, they're the only ones there. So what is God telling us by only creating one man and one woman? That the original design is for monogamous, heterosexual unions. That's what the original design tells us. It doesn't advance the idea of bigamy or polygamy. It doesn't advance any other idea than one man, one woman, one relationship, all time. That's what the design teaches us. So Genesis 2:24, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So that's the original divine design. That's the intention. One man, one woman, all time. 15, the verse is from Genesis 2 and is recorded following the creation of woman and man, a man and woman, and Adam's recognition of the unique relationship that God had established between the first man and the first woman. And again, it's sort of here, it doesn't come across so much in English, but there's almost an interjection here. Like, aha! Adam felt pretty good when he saw Eve. Well, she was a knockout for one thing. I mean, God does not create dogs. And she was pretty well put together as well. She was built, literally, if you follow. So when Adam saw all this, he was pretty psyched. But what had been Adam's problem? What was the issue? Well, we know, verse 18, the Lord God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. And so God recognized loneliness as a bad thing. And this is why people generally tend to get married. It deals with the fundamental issue of human loneliness, of being alone in this world. And so this is why, obviously, in some cases, ill-advised marriages happen, not well-thought-out marriages. All kinds of things can happen. Then there's the, in a sense, what we also have going on is the sort of societal pressure that exists. And this is worse in some places than in others. I understand that. But there are people that just run around and they think it's their job to make sure that everybody gets married. That they figure, you know, they want to play matchmaker. Well, number one, there's nothing in the Bible about doing that. So avoid it. God doesn't need you to figure out what His plan is for somebody else. You'll do fine if you can just figure out what His plan is for you and execute it. You'll do well. So then there's this pressure for people to get married. Oh, when are you going to get married? When are you going to have kids? None of your business. And if everybody would just answer those questions with that answer, you know, maybe it would shut people up. I don't know. None of your business. Don't ask me that again. It's none of your business. Stay out of it. And so people want to, they think they're helping, though. I get it. They think they're helping. But it doesn't help things. And in many cases, to push people into ill-advised, ill-thought-out marriages is just stupid. And is a violation of the divine order. First, Adam and Eve, their volition was not coerced in any way in this matter. They were not under any pressure from any place to do this. So therefore, God put them together, and, you know, as it were, nature took its course. But, you know, here you got a perfect man and a perfect woman. Whoopee! Well, guess what? Even that marriage didn't survive in that sense because they both fell from perfection. So, and here's what people think. Oh, this person's just perfect. I just love them. They're so perfect. Oh, God. Then they get married. And they find out, oh, they're not so perfect after all. And they do all kinds of things that'll just drive you nuts. And so then they get into, well, maybe I shouldn't have gotten married. Well, that's just buyer's remorse in some cases. We know that's a real phenomenon too, by the way. And so people get cold feet. Well, they really should. If they're going to get cold feet, you better get it before you get married. Because after marriage, the divine design is you got to stay married. And that's just the facts. So this is why we tell people, think about it, pray about it. When we review the doctrine of marriage, my advice to people has always been, why are you in such a hurry? Don't be in a hurry, because you better be certain on this one. This one is a big deal. You can make other mistakes. You can take the wrong job. You can buy the wrong car. You can end up in the wrong house even. But you don't want to make a mistake in this area. And as much as people may push you to do things or not do things, the point is I would counsel restraint and prayer. But when people are, you know, their libido's all cranked up and they want to get married, well, you know, it's about as good as talking to, you know, this piano. Please, piano, straighten up. The piano won't listen. The piano just does its thing. And so here I at least have, you know, a room I can fill with hot air and tell people, here's what the Bible says and here's what my sense of spiritual wisdom would tell you. Take it easy on this one. Be careful. Be sure. As much as you can be sure. And obviously you never know what's going to... See, that's the problem with marriage. You never know what it's going to be. And you get up there and you say stuff like, for better or for worse. And then it gets worse. And you think, I didn't really mean that. I really meant for better. I only want to marry you if it's going to be better all the time. I'm not here to deal with your problem. No, it's not that way though. That's the fact. It's not that way. Better or worse, sickness and health. So what are you going to do? You know, of course, given the Pharisees, we know what they did. If the wife got sick, he could divorce her. You know, it didn't, and it could be that something that simple, just getting sick, or some chronic physical problem. What if your husband or wife develops some chronic problem? That's going to test your love. And one of the greatest love stories, frankly, was a woman, frankly, that got divorced. And she ended up married the second time to C.S. Lewis. And if you're not familiar with that story, it's one worth reading. There's a movie called Shadowlands that's about it, if you ever get a chance to see it. She ended up with cancer, bone cancer. And so she died. But he took care of her and, you know, did all the right things and applied the doctrine. And people think, well, okay, you know, that's all romantic. Yeah, until you have to do it. Then it's real difficult. Well, here you have one man, one woman, pretty clear, divine intentions, pretty obvious in Genesis to me. And it was to Jesus. So 16, although Jesus is introducing passages that the Pharisees might not have thought to be directly relevant, it is clear that his plan is to appeal to the original purpose of God, which contrasted with their orthodox, quote, but superficial view of marriage. In 17, the point being made is that the purpose in creating a male and a female was their union under divine institution number 2, marriage, which will actually come to supersede parental authority at some point. Now, why do you figure Genesis 2:24 is here? Well, Adam and Eve never had a father and mother to leave, so it didn't apply to them. It's Moses' commentary on what the divine design is. And so when people get married, the man leaves his father and mother and sets about to establish his own house, his own authority, and all those factors, and provide an environment for his wife. See, this is another thing. If a man's not fiscally responsible and can't provide, what makes him think he should be getting married? That's dumb. And women that marry men that can't provide, dumber. Sorry, but that's the way it is. I mean, and you see these 17, 18, 19-year-old kids, you know, working part-time at McDonald's, and they think they're going to live on that? You're going to provide for a family with that? Now, I'm not against any work. Any work is honorable. I've said that 100 times. I'm not against working at McDonald's or anywhere else. But can you support a person? If you can't, you've got no business getting married. No business whatsoever. Just from a physical, purely financial standpoint. The odds of, and what are the biggest pressures in marriage? The number one reason for divorce, money. And the pressures associated with that. Now, there's no guarantee, of course, if you marry a rich sugar daddy, that it's going to be all right either. So on the other hand, don't think, well, okay, I've got to look for somebody who can support me. Well, that's true, you should. I mean, that's just common sense to me. But you could marry some rich guy, you know, it's no guarantees that it's going to work out just because he can provide for you. Well, 18, the only actual reason the Bible records as a justification for rejection of parental authority is found in the Genesis account of the first marriage. And 19, that is not to say that there might not be other situations that might make such a course of action correct. However, it is to say that the norm would seem to be that one is to remain under parental authority until such time or he or she is ready to marry and begin a new family unit. that we can say, we can safely say that. Now, there may be other reasons for leaving home. Let's say you say you're positive and your parents are negative and they're hostile and they're making your life a living hell. Well, at 18, you'd probably want to get out of there because of spiritual issues. But that's, obviously, that's there are very few cases in which this happens, but it could happen. So I could make an argument for that. That, you know, if your parents are just, you know, they're hostile to God and they're hateful in every way and they make your life a living hell for coming to Bible class, well, yeah, it might be time to move out on your own. You know, or better yet, with someone else. Again, the point is, but that would be an exception to the rule. That's generally not going to be the rule. But I can see where that might happen. So I make account for things like that, or at least try to take them into account. But one thing I can safely say is for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother. And this reason is marriage. That much I can say. Well, 20, the pattern for marriage was established by God and involved a man and a woman entering a relationship that united the two people into one flesh. And 21, in fact, it is evident that from the Genesis account that the only thing that God thought was not good was the fact that the man was lonely. And that we've seen in Genesis 2:18. But if you look at the Genesis account in chapter 1, as he goes about restoring the planet, and how do I know these are literal 24-hour days, by the way? That's another whole question. Some people want to spiritualize Genesis, and they say, well, these are ages. These could have been thousands of years. Wrong. Eh. You can't exegete if you think that. Because there's one little bitty tip in here that tells you they're literal 24-hour days. And it's the words evening and morning. Those are never used metaphorically. They're only used literally. I mean, we know what evening is. Now, day and night, those are used metaphorically in places. But evening and morning, never used in any other way to mean other than evening and morning. Day one, one day. And so what is it that God does as he does all this? As you watch him and he created all of this. And verse 12, God saw at the end of it, verse 10, God saw that it was good. And verse 12, God saw that it was good. God saw, verse 18, that it was good. And verse 21, God saw that it was good. Well, this is getting monotonous. Is anything not good? Yeah. Genesis 2:18. It is not good for the man to be alone. It's the only thing. God said, loneliness is not a part of my plan. I really don't want people to be alone. Therefore, the formation, point 22, of a unique but complementary counterpart for Adam was the capstone on the restoration process. In fact, woman, we might say, is the finishing touch on God's creation. This is the last thing that I know of that he's created. I mean, obviously he's still creating souls, we get that. But in terms of the Genesis account, the woman is the final crowning jewel on God's creation. Well, that obviously should tell us something there too, about God's regard for women. So 23, as a part of the marriage process, the man is responsible to mentally assert his volition and leave his father and mother. And 24, this must certainly be affected mentally. Really, men, I've met them. I know 55-year-old men who are still mama's boys. Oh boy, they're disgusting to me. I can't stand them, frankly. Never could cut the apron strings. Well, for fully grown men, this is gross. It's okay to have a relationship with your parents. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where mommy's still making your decisions for you and you're 50 years old. You know, that's just gross. That is very gross. That is not God's plan at all. So really, you have to, again, it's got to be affected mentally. Mommy and daddy are to be cut out of the picture at a certain point when you get married. And again, that doesn't mean you have to ignore them or avoid them or any of this. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, though, you've got to assert your own unique identity, and this own now, this new unique union has to be fought for, because parents will try to meddle if they can. That's just the nature of parents. They've always been raising you, you know, if you're the child. They've raised you all your life. Well, then suddenly, all of a sudden, you know, when do you quit being a parent? Well, those of us who have got kids know that you really never do. You never quit being a parent. I mean, you have to, because of certain doctrinal constraints and other factors, you have to cut them loose. But it doesn't mean you love them any less or that you want anything other than the best for them. And, you know, and obviously when parents see their children making what they perceive to be mistakes, they're going to weigh in. It's going to be hard for them to keep out of it, I know. But the reality is you've got to let them go and do their thing. And as a man, you've got to stand up not only to your own parents, but to your wife's parents as well, and tell them in no uncertain terms, these are the rules. I'm in charge. If I want some input from you, I'll ask for it. Other than that, stifle yourself. And let them know if you have to. But again, I've seen people, and the women that are married to these kind of men that won't do this, oh, they're miserable in many cases. They're miserable because deep down they know that that man loves mommy more than he loves her, really. And that's a gross way to live. That'd be better off to be lonely than to live like that, in my opinion. You know, these wimpy males that can't deal with life because they haven't ever cut the apron strings. Well, better do it. Well, again, this must certainly be affected mentally, but it may well involve a physical separation of some sort. However, physical separation is not primarily what is in view, nor is it always necessary. And in fact, if you study, you know, the case histories of the Bible, in many cases, these kids lived really with their parents. They lived in a separate sort of part of the house, we might say. But they lived in great proximity to one another, you know. And in fact, under the same roof in some cases. So it doesn't have to be physically separate, but it's wise to be a certain amount of physically separate. Number one, you can't ever live in your parents' house and assert your own authority. It's their house. It's their authority. And that doesn't ever change. Authority doesn't go away because you get old. So if a person ends up living with their parents, guess what? They violated this. You're not supposed to be living with mommy and daddy. Mommy and daddy are not supposed to be supporting you and financing your lifestyle. And as a parent, if I've made mistakes, and I have, believe me, but one of my biggest mistakes was ever trying to help my children financially. Stay out of it. I know that's hard, though. Boy, it breaks your heart. But this is one where you better be tough because it just creates problems, believe me. And so you have to make this separation. And the fact is, a certain amount of physical space is a part of this. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to move a million miles away, but, you know, you do need your own house, you do need your own domicile, you do need your own castle if you're a man. Because you can't be king of in somebody else's castle at all. Nor can your wife be queen in somebody else's castle. So the verb katalipo here is used of leaving a place with the implication of finality. It can also be used to mean to set something aside in the interest of something else. And that's essentially what you're doing. You're setting aside the authority and rights and privileges and all that of your parents, and now you're transferring your loyalty and allegiance to your wife alone. And if that's not what marriage is, you're never going to make it. I guarantee you the marriage will implode at some point if that's not what marriage is. It's got to be a sold-out 100% union. That's why I've taught, and I will teach again, there is no place for the word divorce in the vocabulary of a believer. Now, murder you can use, but not divorce. You may want to kill them. Oh, anybody that's ever been married, you tell me you've never wanted to kill your wife sometimes? Or your husband? Yeah, probably. You've probably gotten that mad. No, we never fight. Well, then one of you is brain dead. Which one of us? Who's had the lobotomy? Let me know. You know? You fight, you get mad. Do you want to kill them sometimes? Sure. And you can say that, I want to kill you. You're not allowed to touch them or hit them or hurt them or any of that. I mean, and so what do men do when they get mad and they fight and they want to kill their wives? They clam up. And if the wife is really mad, she probably doesn't care because she's over there doing the same thing. And they're like this with their backs to each other. Well, guess what? That's fine if you can work through it. That's far better than using the D word. That's what we're going to start referring it to it as, the D word. Because this doesn't need to be in the vocabulary of believers, frankly. And it is, but I understand all that. But still, here's what the divine design is. So in this case, of course, the authority of the parents is set aside in favor of a spiritual and physical union with one's wife. 27, it was common in Israel for the wife to leave her parents behind, but not the husband. The bond is formed with the new wife is physical and psychological and involves transferring his loyalty to his new wife. And 28, it is understood commonly that the relationship between parents and children is the closest relationship that exists in a family. For one to abandon this bond and seek to form another bond with someone that one meets later in life must only be explained as the purpose of God being fulfilled. So what is the general will of God? The general will of God is for people to get married. I mean, this the whole idea of creating a man and a woman. And as we grow up, most people will eventually get married. The vast majority of people will. There are people that won't. But they are the exceptions. They're not the rules. And so all of this is formed with the idea that God intends people to marry. Okay, that's fine. We know, all right, God's in favor of marriage. He is. But marriage under His rules and His terms. Just like God's in favor of salvation. But you can only get it one way. God's in favor of getting all believers to know the entire realm of doctrine. But there's only one system by which you can actually do it. So God's in favor of a lot of things. But you got to play by God's rules. And if you don't do that, well, there are going to be repercussions. Again, you can violate certain smaller principles of doctrine, but divine institutions are big. These are huge. So 29, the result is a sexual union that renders the couple one flesh. Since there is a physical union that complements the spiritual union, it should only be broken by physical means. Well, we know, now your one legitimate out here is you can always pray for him to die, I guess. Now, if that becomes a part, a regular feature on your prayer list, dear God, please kill my wife. I would suggest that there's something possibly wrong. Now, there's some understatement. So Romans 7:2, for the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he is living. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law concerning her husband. So then, if while her husband is living, she is joined to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, so that she is not an adulteress, though she is joined to another man. And Paul's going to take this and use this as an analogy for our spiritual death with Christ and our union with Him. But the point is well enough taken and easily enough understood to my thinking here, and that is, okay, if they die, you're off the hook. Then you can say, well, I didn't divorce them, they died, and so I'm fine before God. Well, yes, you are. You absolutely would be. Well, 30, the conjunction hosta here serves to introduce the last portion of verse 8. Is inferential in force and has the idea of thus, so, or accordingly. And in a lot of cases, it's used to introduce, of course, result. So as a result, in verse 8, the two shall be one flesh. That's the word translated so here. So that, for this cause, for this purpose, for this reason, again, as a result, they are no longer two, but one flesh. And 31, the two individuals are now united in a union that is considered permanent and indivisible. One being considered that, you know, the word one is that which cannot be divided. One signifies the idea of unity, an indivisible nature. Thus, it is not only that the unity should not be broken, it is that it cannot be broken. And 32, verse 9, clearly relates all marriage to God Himself. When the two individuals determine to marry. Now, this obviously, while God is the author of this and is seen as the one who affects the union, clearly the volition of the two individuals is involved. They have to make choices. So when the two individuals determine to marry, they submitted themselves to the divine institution, which carries with it the responsibility to fulfill the requirements of God's will. So, what I tell people when they're young, and especially if you're young, marriage is hard. Now, can marriage be rewarding? Sure, of course it can, or why would people stay married? It can be rewarding, but it's work sometimes. Again, you're going to go through ups and downs and sideways things, and all manner of things are going to happen to a marriage. Every pressure in the angelic conflict is going to seek to explode this union. Why? Because God's for it, so we know Satan's against it. We know the demons actively work against it. And they're fairly, obviously, as we see, pretty successful with just the terms, just the percentages of people that don't make it. And so knowing all this, the best way to me is to equip believers with a strong, solid doctrine that lets them know, okay, here's God's will in the matter. And I've got to keep that before me at all costs. So I'm not free to just marry, divorce, remarry. People do it. But the question is this God's will? That's what that's what each individual believer has to answer for themselves. See, I can't live anybody's life. Nor is it my job to. I can barely live mine. And I can't do everybody else's. And it's too big of a burden, trust me. Even though I feel the pressure of it sometimes. But the fact is, God's grace is sufficient for all of us. Well, 33, the text does not indicate exactly how and when this union is effected. Some believe that the public ceremony, at which time one offers a public vow, affects the union, while others believe the union to be consummated with the first sexual act. Well, 34, while both are technically required, that does not in any way affect the reality that Jesus is declaring that marriage is a permanent union between a man and a woman. And in fact, I would suggest, because God says what God has joined together, and that's exactly what I say at the end of a marriage ceremony. What God has joined together, let no man separate. So, to my thinking, the union is affected when you utter those vows. That's when the union becomes real. The second you take that vow before God. And what do we know about vows? Ecclesiastes 5. Do not be too hasty to utter vows. Watch your tongue. And more, there is talking about vows in general. But clearly, this one's really important because this is a divine institution. And again, when people run around and try to play matchmaker and get people to get married and all of that, to me that shows a real low view of the fact that this is a divine institution. This isn't for you to meddle in. Much as you might think, well, these two are made for each other. Well, you don't know. How do you know? You got some in with God that none of the rest of us have? I don't think so. So again, I suggest to you that the union becomes effective when the guy says, I now pronounce you. By the authority vested in me, I pronounce you man and wife. And so when I say those words, who makes a man and wife? God. Who's saying the words? Me. But that's when it happens, in my opinion. Once that happens, and once that's pronounced, boom, you're done. Well, you're done. You're married. And everybody goes, woohoo! They start clapping. Oh, we're just so happy. Yeah, well. Hang out for a few years with them and we'll see how happy you are. Let's hope they make it past the first 5 years, because the odds are statistically many of them won't. And the younger they are, the more likely they're not going to make it, because they don't have any understanding of this stuff, of all that we're talking about. And yes, are these hard principles? Yes, they are. They're very high principles. And the fact that our society and our culture is in trouble is because we have blown these off. And there isn't anybody in this congregation that hasn't been touched by divorce. Everybody here has. So if you think I'm picking on anybody, we're all in the same boat. I'm not picking on anybody. But these are the principles that need to be taught, and the fact that they aren't being taught in churches and with this kind of force is part of our problem, is that pastors mealy-mouth this stuff, and they back down on it. And guess what? Here's the rules, people. I didn't make them. But it's my job to enforce them to the extent that I can. And obviously God has to do all this. There's not a whole lot I can do. I can't stop people from doing stupid stuff. I can sometimes not even stop myself from doing stupid stuff. So you don't have much of a chance. 34, all both are technically required again. Here the point is it's permanent. 35, the action of God in joining the two individuals into a single unit is seen in the verb soon zegnumi, which literally means to fasten to one yoke or to yoke together. And it is clear, point 36, that Jesus viewed God himself as the ultimate agent that affected the union, and that he takes the marriage vows to be an expression of his will in the matter. And 37, in fact, verse 9 highlights the distinction between the God and mankind. Although some have attempted to limit this statement to the husband, the term anthropos, man or mankind, is generic and is never used to refer to a husband. The term oner can be used to refer to a husband. It's more typically the term that would be translated husband. But the anthropos, now he's talking about, in a sense we could translate this very well, let no human being separate them. And that includes both men and women. So anybody that would be involved in attempting to effect a separation in a marriage is clearly at odds with the revealed will of God. The Bible's very plain on this. There's no wiggle room here. Men are not supposed to do this. Mankind, men or women, human beings are not supposed to do this. So 38, the change from aner, a male, a man, or a husband in verse 2. And essentially, like I told you in verse 2, when they came up to him, a good interpretive translation here is they were asking him whether it was lawful for a husband to divorce his wife. And that communicates what the Greek has there. For a man to divorce the wife. Well, it's a husband. Clearly, a husband and a wife are in view in verse 2. So that fact that it's changed to anthropos is exegetically critical. This indicates that mankind at large, the husband, the wife, or any other person, does not have the right to seek to undo the union that God has established. And 39, the use of the negative may, no or not, with the present imperative of the verb kerizo, to divide or separate, normally prohibits an action already in progress. And with this statement, Jesus effectively says, everybody needs to stop divorcing. Well, you can imagine what this does in a society where, like ours, divorce is viewed as just a reality that you can't do anything about. Jesus didn't feel that way. He didn't say, I can't do anything about it. He said, this is God's will. And here is what God's plan is. Take it or leave it. That's all you can do with people, is tell them what God's plan is, and then they take it or leave it. So again, Jesus would effectively said, what God has joined together, stop letting human beings separate. Quit it. In short, quit it. So here's the will of God from now on out for every one of us here. No more divorce ever. That's it. Quit it. We can't do it. It's off limits to believers, to positive believers. It's off limits, period. But we can't go back and undo the past. So there's no point in feeling guilty about anything that's happened yesterday. Because you can't change yesterday. But you can change today and you can change tomorrow. Yesterday, it's done. So that the beauty of all of this is, as strongly as Jesus words all this, that at the end of the day, there is still grace. That if people fail, guess what? There's still grace. The grace of God is still operative and available to people. All they have to do is avail themselves of it. Well, 40, although it is evident that human legislation has addressed this matter of divorce, Jesus makes it clear that human legislation does not supersede divine legislation. So the people that argue, well, we've got to acknowledge what the law does. We do, but we don't have to say that it's correct, just because, especially if it's antagonistic and hostile to what Jesus has taught. We have to say, well, no, Jesus is correct, and even though the law does this, that doesn't make it right. Essentially, God instituted capital punishment. The fact that men don't exercise it now is irrelevant to God's will. It's still God's will for a murderer to die and not to be coddled in prison for, 8, 10, 12, 15 years. We know because the sentence is not executed against an evil deed. The hearts of the sons of men are fully set to do evil. But if you knew, there's this, I saw this morning this guy, for whatever reason, we don't know why yet, but for whatever, he flips out yesterday or whenever it was, or night before, and he kills everybody in his family, and then calls his sister or somebody and says, I'm thinking about killing myself, I've just killed everyone. Well, we don't need a long time to sort this one out. I can pretty well tell you what needs to happen, and it needs to happen tomorrow, not next year, not 5 years down the road. It needs to happen tomorrow. This man needs to be executed. He's a danger to society. He can't live in it. He's shown that. I don't want to turn him loose. So 41, at this point, Jesus offers no further commentary. Since it is his assertion that the Genesis account revealed the divine intention in marriage, his conclusion is that marriage is for one man, one woman, and for a lifetime. 42, those that would take another position are at odds with the intentions that God that have clearly been set forth in Genesis, and which now are explicitly confirmed by Jesus himself. So, Jesus is essentially saying, look, God's will in this matter has not changed, no matter what else has happened in this world. God's will in the matter hasn't changed. And this is what it has to be. And 43, however, the fact that we know that divorce is a very present reality and has been a reality in the human race since the earliest times. Again, we don't know when it started. But by the Mosaic law, it was recognized as a pre-existing condition. And it probably had been. We know that the divine institution was thwarted very early on. You saw Lamech there. He was the first polygamist. And he took multiple wives. Well, see, it didn't take him forever to start violating this. And no doubt divorce came in early on as well. We're not told about it, but it, no doubt it did. And the implication is, Jesus says, well, just because it's existed and just because it's been this way doesn't mean that God's for it. And so he just clearly sets forth, here's what God's will is, no matter. And I'm not going to back off on that. And of course, this does not make Jesus popular at all with the religious leadership who were, again, as guilty of this as anybody in that time. Well, 44, in fact, the current figures indicate that approximately 50% of first marriages end in divorce, approximately 65% of second marriages, and 74% of third marriages end in divorce. Well, those numbers don't lie. The numbers do not lie. And the odds grow against you every time. See, if people aren't taking this as a serious divine institution that isn't to be violated, well, what makes you think they're going to start? Until somebody stands them up and says, here's the will of God in this deal, people. We've got to go by this. I don't care what the world is doing. This has to be our standards. And 45, given these distressing figures, each pastor, teacher, and local church must understand the high regard that God has for marriage. It is a divine institution. And seek to stand for the truth of doctrine in spite of the cultural rejection of this truth. And 46, while standing for the principles of the faith is important, believers must also acknowledge the reality that God's intentions are not always fulfilled in a world that is filled with sin natures and dominated by the forces of darkness. We recognize we're living in a hostile environment. The environment, the very culture out there is at odds with your spiritual matriculation. It's set against it. And because people can make these arguments, well, this is a reality, so we just have to accept it. No, we don't. No, we don't. We don't have to accept it. Just because people say you have to accept it doesn't mean you do. And yes, I will not argue with you that it's a reality. But what is the case? One man, one woman, all time. Therefore, point 47, we must acknowledge that divorce is not God's directive will, but he does permit it. Okay, if you're divorced and you aren't dead, then, okay, God's permitted it. He's allowed it. He's tolerated it. Nevertheless, believers must acknowledge, obviously you got to acknowledge it, you got to deal with it, it's something you have to confess. But that's the beauty of it. It's like all sins, right? How many times do you have to confess a sin? Once is all I know. If we confess our sins, whatever they may be. Is divorce a sin? Yes. Can I rebound it? Yes. You say, well, then you're effectively undermining marriage. No, I'm not. If I'm doing anything, it's not undermining marriage by this teaching. But can people rebound and go on? Yes, they can. If they couldn't, then my word, this would be horrible. And that's why the disciples immediately said, this is horrible. It's better off not to get married then. And so they freak out and run off in the opposite direction. No marriage for anyone ever. It's too hard. No, marriage can be great. Marriage can be rewarding. Marriage can be fun. It has its work and its job, but it's like anything else. You know, those guys worked really, really hard all up until last weekend, and then they played the Super Bowl, but only one team wins. So all the other team, they did all that hard work, all that sacrifice, all those pressures, all those workouts, and guess what? They didn't quite get there. Well, the Giants got there. They win. And you can win in life with this. Marriage is designed to be a blessing. It's not a straitjacket, for goodness sake. I don't feel that way about my marriage. I'm married and I got to stay married because God won't let me divorce. No, I want to be married. You know, so again, he does believe it, but he does permit divorce, though. And believers must acknowledge it as a personal sin and deal with it as they would any other sin. So you confess it. If you've sinned in this area, you confess it. And you never think of it again. Forget about it. Forget about it. I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. Rebound and move on. That's all you can do. But then, from now on out, now that you got more doctrine, now that you're hearing the truth, okay, well now in the future, we're all more culpable. And I think these passages are very, very plain. In fact, so plain it scared the disciples to death. They got it. Well, 48, the Bible is clear on the fact that any sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven. Therefore, rebound is as efficacious for adultery or divorce as it is for any other mental attitude, verbal or overt sin. Matthew 12:31. So, there is grace after failure. Well, thank God. Even if the failure is divorce, so what? I'm not trying to make light of divorce by any stretch with this teaching, as you can probably tell. But I also have to balance that with, does God have life after divorce? Sure. Sure, He didn't end your Christian life. In fact, God is able to extend even greater grace. Even if there's a failure, okay, doesn't mean my life is over. Matthew 12:31, therefore I say to you, any sin and blasphemy. Well, that covers adultery, it covers murder, it covers divorce, it covers every sin that you can think of. And realistically, let's face it. Why do people walk around with all this guilt? It's because they're not really accepting the efficacious nature of rebound. You have to walk by faith and say, you know, I rebounded that sin once, I don't need to think about it again. And what does God do? We know. What happens when we confess our sins? He forgives, He forgets, and He moves on. So therefore, literally, you remember that sin I confessed 5 minutes ago, and the Lord will go, no. What was it? Well, you don't need to think about it. He's not thinking about it. I will remove your sins as far as the east is from the west. How far is that? Well, they're in completely opposite directions. As east is from the west. And I will wash you, and you will be clean. Well, if you're clean, don't agonize over it. It is really, and it does not behoove a believer to be walking around clean after rebounding and walking around going, I'm dirty, I'm dirty, I'm dirty. No, you're not. You're deluded if you think you're dirty, because after you rebound, you're clean. He's faithful to do what? Cleanse us and forgive us all unrighteousness. So, again, there's grace after divorce, there's grace after adultery. I'm not in favor of divorce or adultery, however. But to say that God's plan is over for anyone that's ever committed those particular sins, well then, what about any other sins? Why isn't God's plan over if you fear, or if you get angry, or if you lust, or if you have pride? Why didn't it end then? Can't you rebound those sins too? Sure. So as difficult as all this appears, the reality is, of course, there still is grace. But then one has to humble himself, and that's not to say that there's not going to be some long, far-reaching ramifications in your life because of this. Because these are, again, we're dealing with a divine institution here. Well, 49, however, it is equally clear that violations of certain doctrines have greater ramifications in the life of a believer than violations of less critical doctrines. Now, am I going to tell you to just, okay, well, the little things, just do whatever you want, but the big things, try to obey. No, I'm going to tell you to try to obey them all. And 50, this is not to say that every principle of the truth is not important and should not be taught and obeyed, Matthew 5:19, because they should. But it is to say that this is a biggie, folks. And in some cases, sadly, the reality is you may only get one shot at it. There may be grace, you may get two if you fail. You may even get three. But that's pushing it, I'm afraid. You might. But if you're going to violate the divine institution over and over and over again, why in the world would God bless you in that area? So the point is, again, we can't do anything about the past. It's done. It's finished. It's dead. We can go ahead from here, though, and say, okay, now I get it. This is a divine institution. That's why God's so big on this. This, in fact, of course, affects every principle in every area of society. 5:19, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them all, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. I've supplied the word all there for clarity. And that's the point. I'm not trying to downplay other sins as being minor. They're sins. Sin is sin is sin. whether it's mental attitude, whether it's verbal, whether it's overt. But the good thing is, there's grace for this. And God gives a greater grace. So it is to say that violations of divine institutions are more significant and carry more significant consequences. Genesis 5, 9, 5, and 6 is a perfect example of that. Because this deals with the violation of divine institution number one. This one is so serious. God takes it so seriously. And if he takes these divine institutions this seriously, well, we better too. That's my point. Genesis 9, 5, and 6. Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it. And from every man and from every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. And God says this extends to animals. So when these dogs attack people, yeah, put them down. I don't have to be a genius to figure that one out. No, turn them loose and let's see what happens. Duh, put them down. If an animal kills a human, put that animal down. I don't care what animal it is. Then people say, well, that's harsh. Well, that's God's rule right here. I didn't make it up. He said, I'm going to require it from the animals as well as from you. And if somebody goes out and commits murder, what's the deal? By whoever sheds man's blood, by man, his blood will be shed. God didn't say, I'll kill him. He said, I'm going to make humankind responsible for this. And this is the violation of divine institution number one, volition. If you violate somebody's volition and remove their right to live, you forfeit your right to live, period. There are no exceptions. I mean, if it's premeditated murder, we're not talking about self-defense. We're not talking about killing in wartime. We're not talking about other factors. We're talking about killing someone either in anger or you snap. People, well, he snapped. He went insane, Your Honor, but he's sane now. I've heard that argument so many times, it's not even funny. Well, of course you've got to be insane to kill somebody, particularly if you know you're going to get killed. And of course, that's insane. But it doesn't mean you're off the hook. And so, well, he was high on drugs, so we can't hold him responsible. Yes, we can. No matter what he did or why. If he did it, he's responsible. That's his deal. Well, he went out and got on drugs and got demon-possessed and did all this weird stuff. Fine, kill him. I don't want those type of people in society, do you? Nope, you sure don't. Also, Mark 10:11. We'll wrap up here with that one, and that's we're going to get this as we get into these next verses. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. I take the her to mean the first wife. And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she is committing adultery. Now, as we point out, can this be rebounded and dealt with? It can. But, again, we have to make... That doesn't mean there will not be repercussions down the road. Just as if you kill somebody, the repercussions from that are far greater than running the stop sign out here. Unless you happen to run a stop sign and a semi's coming and hit you at 60 miles an hour broadside, then the repercussions are really bad. But generally speaking, the repercussions for running a stop sign are not the same as murder, nor are they supposed to be. But now by this, am I saying, well, please, run stop signs? No. I'm just saying that the results might not be down the road as far reaching. But if you get caught, like I did, I have to admit it, I tell myself, I made an illegal turn because, you know, I was in a hurry. And this cop pulls me over and he goes, he said, well, you know, you've got a clean driving record, so I'm going to let you go. But I can give you 115 reasons not to do that again. Oh, you hit me in the wallet. Ow. Well, yeah. Okay. All right. I won't. So the point is, that's the repercussions. $115, life in prison or death. That big gap there, you know, in terms of what happens. Okay, well, our time is more than gone. I ran over a little bit there, but we'll be ready to move on here Tuesday with our next verses. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the privilege of studying your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.